Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitted across the internet, this is episode 263 of Registry Matters. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing well. Did you say 263?
I think so. Is that the right number?
That is the right number, but we've been doing this for way too long.
Oh, should we just quit?
Well, I think so, because there's a competitive program. Narsil is relaunching the Narsil in Action. They're going to relaunch next month. Have you heard about that?
I have not heard about that. Who's going to do that?
Well, we need to give them a shout out and help promote it. But yeah, they're going to launch it with one of the newer board members, and their first guests are going to be attorney Adele Nicholas and attorney Mark Weinberg.
Very good. Good for them. Who's hosting?
One of the board members named David.
I know who you're referring to. Well, cool. Yes. Well, good for them. I hope that works out. We could even have them on to then help cross promote it if they would be interested in that.
I would be delighted to do that. I believe in helping and working in a collaboration. So yes, I would be delighted to do that.
I also think, Larry, that it would be important for people to go over to their favorite YouTube platform of choice or podcast app of choice. I did do that on purpose. And leave a 5-star review and all that, and make sure you hit like and subscribe and press all those buttons and all that stuff. Leaving a podcast app review would help us as well. Maybe it helps some people find the program that might have similar interests in the legal kind of news framework that we are working in. Anything you want to add to that? I know that you keep track of that. You watch that you watch it like a hawk. As soon as someone watches it, you come and tell me that you've seen that somebody watched it.
That's right. YouTube has been growing by subscribers. We're up to, I forget, but it's well over 550, 560 something. So it's growing.
Very good. Very good. Would you tell us what we're doing tonight?
Well, you've got some kind of gobbledygook stuff that you're going to be talking about related to, I don't even know how it fits into the theme of the podcast, but we're going to be talking about defamation and misinformation. And then we have a case from the Michigan Court of Appeals that deals with whether registration is cruel and unusual punishment. Thanks to one of our lovely supporters that we have that case, because I didn't know about it. And then we've got a couple of articles to talk about as well.
Fantastic. First, let's begin with a person on our Discord server posted a question, and almost word for word what it was. I thought it was just about perfect with a tweak or two, and I asked him to send in a voice memo, and I think that this would be right up your alley as a question to be answered. I think it's just framed really well, and I don't want to spoil it, so we'll just dive right into it.
Hi, Andy and Larry. So Larry, you're always talking about how we have to engage with our state lawmakers, and I heard about some bad bills that were recently introduced in our state legislature. Two more bills trying to pass huge 2,500-foot residency restrictions. So I finally looked up who my state reps are, and it turns out one of my state reps is actually on the Judiciary Committee that decides whether these bills will move forward or not. But I'm very nervous about reaching out to her. Larry always says, make a phone call, because emails just get ignored. But I feel a lot of anxiety about making a call like that, especially as a PFR and still a parolee. I mean, I'm not trying to draw attention to myself. I live in a small community, and I worry about my PO, prosecutor, even the cops that I have to provide in-person updates to, deciding that I'm making waves and putting me under a microscope, which I definitely do not need. Plus, it seems kind of pointless because this particular politician ran on sort of a soccer mom-style law and order campaign, promising to make communities safer, protect the children, and all that. So I can't imagine them being very sympathetic to our point of view, much less blocking these bills. Anyway, love to hear your thoughts. I love the podcast. Thank you so much for doing what you do every week. Keep up the good work, and FYP.
Thoughts?
Oh, I have lots of thoughts. First of all, I don't want to diminish his concerns, because they're legitimate about retribution. particularly when you're in the clutches of the system being actively supervised. But I'm just curious as to how, if you were to reach out to your lawmaker, how they would know you're on the PFR list. That has been, I've been working as a staffer for a senator for a dozen years now, and I can't remember us ever looking at the PFR list when someone contacts us.
You don't, the hovercraft doesn't like chime in and go, here's the phone call coming from PFR 17832, and this is the person. Nothing like that happens?
Nothing like that happens. So I can't imagine they would know, but if they did know, then he could definitely, it could be passed back on to the people he named. And I would not say that it's beyond the realm of possibility that there could be some adverse consequences. I mean, there's one state that's purest of wind-driven snow, and I'm assuming we're not talking about that state. What state are we talking about here? Do you know?
It is nearby that state, but it is not that state. It is in roughly kind of like the lower end of the Northeast. How about that?
Well, if it's Pennsylvania, that's not a pure wind-driven state, but that would change, depending on the state, the changes the dynamics. I'm going to guess that it's Pennsylvania.
Okay.
So if it's Pennsylvania, I would be better prepared if I knew if this is a Senate bill or a House bill. If it's a Senate bill and if it has been sponsored by a Republican, it is going to pass because the Republicans, I mean, it's going to pass the Senate because the Republicans have a significant majority. It's what, 26 to 22. I mean, they have a significant enough majority that they could pass the bill. There wouldn't be anything the Democrat Party could do about it if it's a Senate bill. If it's a House bill, the House is almost evenly divided. Therefore, it would still likely pass the House, but there would at least be some chance that you could modify it and have some discussion about it. If it were me, I would do some research. If we're talking about Pennsylvania, we would look at, I think I vaguely remember there's some kind of court interpretation that there's preemption on residency restrictions except imposed by the state. Now, this is a state proposal, so that preemption won't help you because it's not a community doing it. But I would look at the wording and the language of that opinion to see if there's any goody gems inside contained in it, if there is in fact such a decision. I'd look at that, and then I'd certainly go to looking at decisions from outside of PA that deal with residency and proximity restrictions and how that would be a potential unconstitutional addition to the registry. And I would do something that not a soul would ever do that calls themselves an advocate, because they just cannot have these words flow from their mouth. But I would go in and I would remind the people that this is a civil regulatory scheme.
Yeah.
And I would be able to say the words with a straight face. And that this civil regulatory scheme is in great jeopardy if you try to use it to impose disabilities or restraints. And I would cite to Smith versus Doe, I believe on approximately page 100 of that opinion. I believe that's where it is. But anyway, we talked about it before, and I would say that registration is only constitutional because it doesn't impose any disabilities or restraints. Then I would point to the Sixth Circuit decision out of Michigan, and I would say, look what happened to people in Michigan when they kept ramping up and they added the residence restrictions and proximity restrictions. Look what happened to them. They spent a gazillion dollars and then they are no longer able to enforce that. The registry is too crucial for public safety. We don't want to get into a jeopardy, and we don't want to jeopardize this vital public safety tool. Now, I could say that and keep a straight face. Not a soul listening to this could do the same thing. But that's what I would do if I were in this position. And I would make a credible argument that keeping the registry up and running without these things is vital and critical to public safety. And I would be vilified by my own people saying that I'm a sellout, but I'm trying to keep you from having additional restrictions to deal with in your life. So I don't see it as a selling out. I see it as trying to make your life more livable. If all of a sudden you can't live anywhere, what kind of quality of life are you going to have?
It seems like it would get kind of miserable.
Well, and it is very miserable in a lot of jurisdictions where these restrictions are so huge, particularly I think down in South Florida and Dade County, Miami-Dade County, I think it's 2,500 feet. It virtually makes you subject to living in some kind of industrial zone where there's contaminated waste or something, which I mean, you can't live anywhere. And so that's the type of argument I would make. But I can feel for his concerns and I can understand where he's coming from, but they won't know you're a PFR. But if you have a relationship with the lawmaker, it's not going to matter that you're a PFR. They're probably not going to use you on the front of the campaign literature. But if you have credible good things to offer and you have wisdom and you have some objectivity about you, they are going to listen to you because they're always looking for good information. Almost always. I shouldn't say always, but almost always looking for good information. They don't know all these issues. The members of the PA Assembly, they haven't even thought about the registry. It hasn't come up in years and years. No one's thought about the registry. There's probably very few people that have any understanding of how it works.
I do want to go back to this and ask a question. So when an individual calls and you answer the phone and the person says, "I'm John Doe," like, my name could be Andy and I've told you it's John Doe. Are you looking it up? I mean, you might, like, you would pencil down and say, "Hey, John Doe called and said he's in support of or against such and such, you know, tell the senator." You don't care. Yeah. You're not looking, you're not telling, no. Send me your photo ID.
We don't do that. And I don't work in the Capitol office. I work in the business office, you know, for the day job. So the bulk of the calls are going to the Capitol office, but we don't do that. What is done is when a person says, "I'm a constituent," we may ask for their address. And then we try to figure out, the senator himself, he can tell you almost to the, just based on the address, if it's in the district. I'm not that good with a map. So I will actually go on the app and look and see if the address falls within the district. And that's all we're really concerned about. You're representing everyone who lives in your district, whether they vote for you or against you, whether they're a minor and whether they don't vote, whether they're a convicted felon. You're representing all 60,000 constituents in the district. That's about what it's 55,000-60,000 for a senator here, whatever the number is. You're representing all of them. You're the only voice they have. And people get fixated on the fact that they don't vote. You still have, we represent the school children. They don't vote, right?
I think that's true.
What has a bigger advocacy than education of children?
So Brenda points out in chat, she says, the writer probably thinks he has to say, "I'm PFR and I'm impacted by blah, 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 blah." Does the individual, do any of us have to do that when we call in?
I don't have any reason to think you would need to do that. Now, a very astute staffer might ask you that. Does this have any personal impact on you? Because you're not used to getting phone calls, someone who wants to be concerned about the reaches of the registry. I mean, in the 12 years I've done this, I haven't gotten a single call like that. So I don't think they're going to be a regular. So it may be befuddling you. I think that she's pointing out that when she was in the Capitol there in Maryland and she was telling one of the staffers about something not being good public policy, and basically they blew her off and said, "Why does it matter?" And she says, "Because it's unconstitutional." Hopefully she's smiling, because I do remember that when the person said, "Well, who cares? It's just PFRs." And she said, "Because it's unconstitutional."
I do assume, though, as a relationship would progress along, that you eventually, I mean, I don't know that you ever announce yourself as being the PFR, but you would announce yourself as being your name and introducing yourself and talking to the person on a legit level instead of just somewhat of an anonymous phone call.
Well, that would be true. If you have a relationship, like I say, it's not going to matter as much. They're not going to use you as a campaign spokesperson. But if you're credible, they're going to listen to you.
What would make you credible in this space like that?
Forming a relationship with the person, and you're going to have to do it in a way that, well, since Pennsylvania, I think, is year-round, it's a little bit more difficult. But in most of the states where it's not year-round, you meet them at places. They're doing town halls in their district. You know, they're doing things. You actually run into your lawmakers around the district, around your state, and you talk to them and say, "I live in your district. I would like to have a meeting with you." And you go in and have a meeting. They're not going to do a background check on you to have a meeting for a state a senator or state representative. They're not going to do that. You're not visiting the White House.
Do they ask you for your address to see if you actually are a constituent?
Often that is done. You only have a certain amount of bandwidth, and you're representing a particular group of constituents. And you would like to know if you're spending an hour to have a meeting that they're actually one of your constituents. So yes, it's very common you're going to get asked the address.
And they're going to then do the reverse search to see if this address shows up on the POFR list?
It's never, like I say, I've never even thought of anything like that. This reminds me of the guy in the prison in Fort Leavenworth that was imagining what would happen if it was snowing over in Fort Sill, yes. Oklahoma. I mean, it's like you have to have a vivid imagination. Is it possible? Of course, anything's possible, I guess, but it's not likely.
And then I have to then think that the person is then such a vindictive person that you are calling to oppose something that impacts you negatively, that they're then going to track down your handler and out you so that they can come F with you to make your life miserable because you are in opposition to a bill?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't rule that out if they actually knew, particularly if you were a high-profile offender and you'd done something that was particularly out there. You know, all sex offenses are sensitive. You know, there's a sensitivity in the community to all sexual offenses. But if you had done a high-profile thing, I mean, it would be possible that could happen. But if you've done a really high-profile thing, I wouldn't advise you to get into direct advocacy.
Right. And so then just, since you brought that up, just by extension, what would be ways that you could be an advocate without being, quote-unquote, an advocate?
I guess I don't follow the question. You can be an advocate without being an advocate.
Well, so I mean, this came up. It was along the same lines when this question came in. People were fussing, like, well, we can't even vote. And I was like, I appreciate that you have your one vote and your one vote counts. However, when you have 10 million people in the state and some number of them vote, your one vote does not tip the scale. So there are these other things that you could do.
I get your question. Yes. Well, there's a number of things you could do. Old-fashioned shoe leather is still very popular with campaigns, at least in a rural state. And Pennsylvania has a lot of rural area in Pennsylvania. So what you would do is you would do literature drops for candidates that are more favorable to your views. You would do phone banking. I hate to tell you, they're not going to know that you're PFR if you call them on phone. Now, getting the answer on the telephone is going to be a long shot these days. Right. But we still do phone banking. I don't do it anymore because I get tired of getting one answered out of every 25 phone calls. So I don't do phone banking anymore, but it's still done. They do literature drops. They do door knocking. You can make campaign contributions of financial resources. It takes a lot of money to run a campaign. And I mean, you can go on and on with things you can do to try to impact public policy. You can show up at a town hall and ask a tough question and see what they say. They're not going to know you're a PFR. I hate to tell you, you're not spewing radiation out. They're not going to know that you're on the registry unless you're in a very small town and the town hall's only got 3 people in it. They might know then, but if you're in a room full of 75, 80, 100 people, how the hell are they going to know?
There is a cognitive bias, Larry. It's called the spotlight effect. And it is just, you think, because you know you, that more people know you than actually give a flip about you. No one knows who you are. No one cares. Unless, like you're saying, you live in that little small town and everyone knows everyone. But if you're just in a normal area, then nobody gives a flip about what you're doing.
Well, I get that. There's people who are going into mega churches here. And they tell me that they have been asked to leave. And I said, wait. So the very first day you were in a mega church and they asked you to leave. I said, how would they have known? I don't know. And I said, well, I don't believe that. So you never went to the mega church? Well, I guess I did go a few times before. But did you fill out a visitor card and give it? Well, I guess I did fill out a visitor card. Oh, well, is it possible that they took the visitor card and they did some research on you? Because the mega churches do have some protocols about keeping people safe. But if you just go to worship and you sit in an open service and there's 300, 400, 500 people in a modest-sized church, not even a mega church, I hate to tell you, they're not going to know. They're just not going to know.
Right. Okay, we've done this for 15 minutes. We should move along.
All right.
You gonna ask me a question?
Oh yes, I guess this is my turn. I've got to ask you a question about
yes, sir.
This stuff you put in here. So, I remember watching professional wrestling back in the day. Did you?
I did. So my dad took me as a kid, and the earliest like big Hulk Hogan kind of character that I remember was a guy named Bob Backlund. That's what I remember, and that was like in the '80s, I suppose. I was a little wee guy at that point.
I do remember Bob Backlund.
Do you really?
Know, it wasn't real. Yeah, I do remember him. He used to wrestle in Georgia.
Oh, well, I wasn't in Georgia at that time. That's before he, like, I guess I just would have seen him on TV.
So, of course, now you know that crap wasn't real, don't you?
At the time, man, I was like standing up on the seats in the stadium and I was like, he's got the thing in his hand. Thinking the referee, the only person out of 20,000 people or whatever in the stadium, the only guy that doesn't know who it is, the person that's closest to them, the referee. So I thought it was real. Of course it was real, Larry. What are you talking about?
Well, it was considered real when I watched it, but I figured it out probably in my late teens.
And at what point in time were you watching it when you thought it was real?
When I was in my early teens. Oh, I was fixated on it. It was a way of getting out of the foster home and going to travel to downtown Atlanta and different places where they held it. And it was fun to go watch this spectator sport. But you know, I figured out in my late teens that this was a hogwash.
What year was that, though?
Oh, it was about, I think, early 1900s.
Okay. I see. I gotcha.
So do you think professional wrestling is real now?
I do not. I still wonder how people watch it. And it's, I mean, I do appreciate that they're athletes. I want to call them gymnasts, but it's total theater. I guess that I was somewhat of a slow learner. And I thought it was real at the time.
So, well, how did you come to this conclusion then?
All right. Well, I do recall like watching it on TV. So there was a guy, I cannot remember his name, but he wore a glove. And I want to say his name was The Claw, but I can't remember that for sure. And he would have something in there, and somewhere during the match, he would get the guy pinned. And he would like put his thumb and pinky on the guy's temples and just squeeze and squeeze and squeeze and squeeze, and eventually the guy's head's just like exploding with blood, and they put X's up on the screen, like, you know, when Family Feud, when you get the wrong answer. So that was real, but I was like, okay, this guy is not actually squeezing the guy's head like a grape and making it you know, he's not making the guy bleed. So anyway, these X's would cover up the screen and to cover up the gore.
So, well, this is supposed to be a registry show. I hope we're going somewhere. But anyway, what's wrong with all that? That's entertainment.
All right. Well, to me, if you think about it, this is, to me, if this were actual violence and you are damaging another person, and if we were to then compare it to boxing for a minute, these are, I believe boxing is, I'll use your words, I believe it is a civil regulatory scheme. And otherwise, you are committing assault and battery on a person. Like, and if you're squeezing their head to the point that they're bleeding, like, you've ended up like attempted murder, perhaps. And if that's okay, I mean, you're the legal expert. You tell me, is this a civil regulatory scheme as far as it being like the fighting, like boxing and MMA stuff, is that a civil regulatory scheme that allows them to beat the pulp out of each other and not get charged with assault and battery?
Well, in a sense, I would say yes. But the sports governing authorities do take great lengths to make sure that there's not serious risk for long-term injuries. No, that's not the intent of boxing. Although people do get injured, the blows to the face, you know, can open up a cut, make a black eye. But that's not the point of the boxing. And then there's the long-term consequences of, I think Muhammad Ali had, from all the blows to his head. But the baseball and the football and the regulatory framework, they do try to minimize. I mean, the same thing in this wrestling. If all this was really real, there'd be people getting locked up with all the chairs being crashed over their heads and stuff. But no,
right. And okay, so that makes sense. So then let me transfer this over to the next part of this. Do you know that wrestling is not covered on ESPN?
Covered on what?
ESPN. You've never heard of ESPN?
Yeah, I think I heard of it like 30 years ago. Don't they cover sports?
Yes, it's the Entertainment Sports Network, and they cover the actual news and events of sporting events. And because wrestling is not sport, it's theater, they do not cover it. The matches are staged. They aren't known in advance who's going to win. The storyline, I know, like, it's not like at 10 seconds you're doing this, at 20 seconds you're doing that. It's roughly scripted. So it's odd to me that you can go over to DraftKings and bet on matches, but I guess some people know who's going to win. Like, the McMahon family knows who's going to win the match, but the general population doesn't. So I guess that's why you can vote on it. However, you got a guy like Pete Rose, who he was convicted, I think, and removed from the Hall of Fame, whatever, for insider betting. I believe that's true.
Yes.
All right. So incidentally, on that subject, I found a quote on ESPN's website dating back to 2016 that reads, "To me, the line ESPN has to be careful when crossing is the one separating fiction and nonfiction, real competition and pure entertainment. And pro wrestling is simply well-performed fiction. For a news organization, I think this is a poor fit and one that comes with real risk." And I want to point out again, Larry, it says simply well-performed fiction.
So, well, as they said on the movie A Few Good Men, we need to be going somewhere. This is a PFR show. What does this have to do?
Okay. So, did you hear recently about a news lawsuit against Alex Jones and then the settlement between Dominion and Fox News?
I think I've heard about a just shy of an $800 million settlement with Fox News, yes.
All right. Well, Alex Jones' trial, when it was in Texas, there were multiple states. They awarded the plaintiffs $49 million. $49 million. All he did was tell a few lies, Larry. People considered what is reported on his network to be true. The InfoWars podcast is the 47th most popular podcast. Number one is the BBC NewsHour. Number 10 is Joe Rogan. Dave Ramsey is number 11. And then Laura Ingraham is, she's 20. Mark Levin, this would be your favorite. Mark Levin is number 19. These programs are incredibly popular. And for him to be 41, I mean, he's up there in the rankings as far as the reach that he has. So tell me, from a legal point of view, when YouTube and these other platforms, they took them off saying that they could not post on their platform, is that shutting down their free speech?
Well, I've said all along, no, because you can speak all you want to, but you don't have a right to speak on someone's platform that isn't yours. That's kind of my opinion, but they didn't get sued for saying something, but for the damage that resulted from what they said. Their words caused harm. And let me give an example, a comparison. Do you remember the Democratic primary in Iowa where they used the new voting system?
I think I recall something about it.
Well, they used a new process and technology, and things didn't go smoothly in that election. And the reporting on it wasn't slanderous. It was factual. There were problems with the app, as it was called. And that's fine to report on it. But when you go and say things that are not true, that you know are not true, that's a different standard, because those words can be harmful.
You're making my point. So you have a news organization, and their mission is to provide information, news, facts, both sides of the story, all that stuff. And in the heat of the moment, if it's late breaking news, I've heard them say, hey, look, this is happening and we're getting information and it might not be accurate, but we're reporting what's important, what we know about at this very moment. They may have to take it back later from what was originally reported for the record. Whoops, we said it last week and there were so many casualties and we know that it's not what it was, not that many. However, the statement made by Fox News is this in the settlement. We are pleased to have reached a settlement of our dispute with Dominion Voting Systems. We acknowledge the court's ruling finding certain claims about Dominion to be false. This settlement reflects Fox News' continued commitment to the highest journalistic standards. We are hopeful that our decision resolved this dispute with Dominion amicably instead of the acrimony of a divisive trial allows the country to move forward from these issues. Listen to that carefully, though, Larry. It says claims about Dominion to be false. They said they changed the vote. It didn't say they lied, but this is just wordsmithing, at least the way that I'm taking it. Like, the people on these news channels, Fox News just being one, they lied repeatedly and for years again, let's go back to ESPN. They don't cover professional wrestling because it's theater. They don't want to cross that line of covering theater, as it isn't their mission. Their mission is to report facts of sports. Media magnate Rupert Murdoch knew that his Fox News hosts were endorsing lies spouted by the former president, yet he did nothing to stop them. You had the news people of Fox wanting to report the truth, yet you had the opinion people like Tucker and Hannity, who get the highest ratings on television, spewing lies and repeating them.
Well, you're getting all worked up here. We have to be careful. Now, the people like Hannity, when they're giving their opinion, that's okay. If you know you're watching an opinion show, but when you're watching what is supposed to be news, the news is supposed to be as accurate as it can be. And there's a different standard there, but you're beginning to sound like me, because I try my best to be as accurate. We both try our best to be accurate on this program. We will probably make some mistakes tonight, but they're not intentional. And if someone shows those mistakes to us, we will come back in a future episode and say, whoops, we're sorry. Fox News didn't do that. They were shown the evidence that they were wrong. And it took $787 million and a lot of litigation. And also, they've got several more lawsuits pending. And they're not likely to go well. You just can't defame a company by making false statements like they did. You just can't do that. You don't have that right unless you're willing to pay. You're hurting the people who designed those systems. You're hurting the reputation of the employees that work so hard. You're hurting the election officials who monitor the elections from both sides of the aisle. You're doing all this harm. You're undermining public confidence in elections, and you're doing that all for the sake of the almighty dollar. The only way we can get your attention is to take some almighty dollars from you, and that's what's happened here.
All right, well, you need to take a deep breath now. But hang on. So I have one other point that I want to make, and I was just curious. Have you heard of The Onion or Babylon Bee?
I've heard of The Onion, but I don't think I've heard of the other one.
All right. Well, they're both satirical websites, and they're quote unquote news. But so from Wikipedia, The Onion is an American digital media company and newspaper organization that publishes satirical articles on international, national, and local news. The Onion's articles cover current events, both real and fictional, parodying the tone and format of traditional news organizations with stories, editorials, and the man-on-the-street interviews, using a traditional news website layout and an editorial voice modeled after that of the Associated Press.
Oh, well, thank you for your report about The Onion. What's the point?
All right, well, the point is this. Some headlines on The Onion read right now are, Sarah Huckabee Sanders eats a kid. Jimmy Carter gets a vasectomy reversed. Biden shoots self in the foot in hopes of getting discharged from presidency. And this one is great. Conservatives explain why child marriage should be legal. And on then Babylon Bee, there is Fetterman filibusters Senate for 7 hours while attempting to say hello. You cannot go to these sites and read them for more than 30 seconds to realize that something is wrong. It's so good at pushing the envelope of being legitimate sounding, but obviously not telling the truth. And I was going to say it doesn't say it's news, but it does say that it's news. It's just ridiculous. And it's not trying to mask itself as real news. This is actually what would be fake news. But I cannot figure out for the life of me, Larry, how people continue to support these news organizations. Fox News is one. Newsmax is another one. And with that level of disregard for truth. So anyway, but back to my previous thought. It's just insanity because of these lies and the prevalence of people believing untruths just to support the preconceived beliefs. You had a peaceful protest where the Capitol was stormed over a blatant known lie, and it continues. And Trump is going to run for president again, and he really has high numbers. Do you think it will matter, though? I'm just wondering, does the 700, whatever, 84, 6, whatever it was, is going to hurt either his numbers or Fox News's numbers?
It's hard for me to see that anything would hurt his numbers, being Trump. But with Fox, it will hurt, because remember, they have shareholders. To be the fundamental requirement of capitalism is to provide profits to your shareholders and not give away money unnecessarily. And they're going to have to do an analysis of all this pending litigation and whether they need to modify any of their business practices in view of the substantial losses they may be facing. So I think it will temper Fox News. Are they going to magically become a great objective news source? Probably not. But I think that, like, wasn't there a text from Tucker Carlson to what's her name, saying, hey, you know, you don't have any evidence of this. You need to knock it off. Laura Ingraham, wasn't there a text
showing there were that he, like, I don't want to speak specifically to, I know that he had inside communications with people. I just don't know what it was.
Well, I mean, Tucker Carlson's not exactly the paragon of objectivity, but if he's saying, hey, we're on thin ice here, it should have been adhered to. But I think it will make some difference with Fox. I really do. And I hope it does.
And ultimately, Larry, I got to ask, what the hell is wrong with people? That's all ultimately, that's what I wanted to ask you, is what the hell is wrong with people? And it took me 15 minutes to set it up.
Well, it's something I've been asking you myself about the YouTube channels that I watch and the people that just gravitate to watch channels that are blatantly telling them lies, blatantly misinforming them, and doing it because it drives their click count and their subscription base. And they do that. They have to know that some of the stuff that they're saying is lying. And I know that they know it because I go and post to some of them, tell them, hey, you're wrong about this. That's not factually correct. But people apparently have a need to be angry and to be misled and to, I don't know. I wish I could explain it, but apparently people enjoy being angry and being mad and being scared. You know, Social Security is going to quit paying benefits. Really? They haven't missed a payment since 1940. So 80 plus years now, and they're going to stop paying people. No, it's not going to happen. Can you imagine when there's 66 million people collecting benefits? Can you imagine if they didn't make the payment cycle in May or June or July, the cataclysmic consequences that would have for the U.S. economy? There are people who wouldn't be able to pay.
I like those.
They would not be able to pay their rent. They would not be able to pay their co-pays. There are people who that's either the majority or the entirety of their income. Do you actually think Congress is going to allow 66 million people to not be paid? Really? But yet there are
people. And these aren't just... These aren't the homeless people we were talking about pre-show. These are grandmas and so forth, grandmas and grandpas.
Yes, and these are people who by and large vote. 66 million people would register complete resentment at the polls if that happened. So, yeah, that would be, if it did happen, I mean, anything's possible, there'd be grandstanding and there'd be people trying to point the finger at whose fault it is. But the bottom line is, it's your job to work out a solution, and a solution will be worked out as it always is. You've got more things to be worried about than whether you're going to get your precious Social Security check. You're going to get it. Anyway, that wasn't the topic, but it's why do people want to be mad about stuff that doesn't exist? People wanted to be mad about election fraud that wasn't happening.
All right, enough of that. I will stand down off of my soapbox and let you have it back.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Let's move over to Michigan Court of Appeals, cruel and unusual punishment. And you have a case that you put in here for tonight. The Michigan Court of Appeals, and it's people of the state of Michigan versus Andrew Michael Swaffer Sauls. Never heard of that name before in my life. Larry, I did read it while I was at lunch today, and I've read it 47 times, so I have a lot of questions for you. Are you ready?
I'm ready. So why did you read it so many times? Were you totally without anything productive to do today?
I had absolutely nothing to do. I just wanted to make sure that I could come up with some good questions for you. Let me set this up. The matter before the Court of Appeals on remand from the Michigan Supreme Court, the directions were to consider defendant's argument that the imposition of lifetime registration violates the state prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment in the state and federal constitutions. Before you start going off on your little pontificating scheme, I know that you really don't have much faith in that argument. Can you please explain your reason why?
Sure. The cruel and unusual punishment clause is a very difficult standard to meet. If putting people, God, I've said this and we've played countless Scalia clips. If putting people to death by very gruesome means is not considered cruel and unusual, it's difficult for me to imagine or conceive of anything short of a painful death that would be considered cruel and unusual punishment. And we've played, I don't know if you have one handy, but we've played him saying that. It's not cruel and unusual punishment. And that's the conservative view on cruel and unusual punishment. So if you've got one, play it. If not, we can just move on. But if you can put people in a torture chamber and juice their body up and fry them and have them convulsing and vomiting, and if you can put them in a gas chamber and you can have them doing the same things, can you say that if that isn't cruel, how would you ever meet the standard?
I don't have one handy, but I do like this one.
Stupid but constitutional. Whack. Stupid but constitutional. Whack. Stupid but constitutional.
That's like one of my favorite ones.
Okay.
Well, the court stated, we decline to address the issue in the defendant's first appeal in which we affirm defendant's convictions but remanded for resentencing. They had suggested that the defendant could raise the issue to the trial court regarding lifetime PFR registration. Now that they have addressed the issue of lifetime registration, what did they decide?
Well, to keep the suspense down before we go into it, they decided that lifetime registration is not cruel and unusual punishment. What a surprise.
Yeah, no doubt. I know that you have always claimed that the courts can be influenced by the particular facts pertaining to the challenger. Do you think that that had any impact in this case?
I certainly can't rule it out. The facts of this case are not particularly appealing, to say the least. And I know that you prefer not to be graphic on this family-oriented program, but do you mind reading from the facts as they were articulated by the court?
I will censor if I feel necessary. So the complainant, an adolescent female, went to the park with a sister and a friend to play basketball. She stopped at the home of an adolescent boy that she knew in an attempt to borrow his air pump to inflate her basketball. That sounds harmless. The defendant, who the complainant had not previously met, also stayed at the home of the adolescent boy. The males invited the complainant into the home and into the defendant's room under the guise that they would help with the basketball. According to the testimony, once in the bedroom, the door was shut and the males threw condoms at the complainant and called her derogatory names, including sexually themed ones. They then struck her on the leg, attempted to force her to swallow a pill, forced her onto the bed, kicked her, and touched her lady bits. The complainant testified that they forced her legs open and touched her everywhere. Then the defendant tried going, and I'll stop pretty much there, all legs on, and that's not pretty. That's not at all pretty. I'll leave it there.
So it is not pretty, and could the facts have affected the outcome of this case? Absolutely, yes.
I mean, that sounds like that would be rape in my mind. The defendant was convicted by a jury of assault with the intent to commit sexual penetration. CSC-4? Yes. CSC?
Criminal sexual... I forgot what it was, but yeah, that's okay. The charge in Michigan.
Okay, CSC-IV, which would be CSC-4, felonious assault stalking, along with sentencing him to prison for the convicted offense, the trial court also imposed a requirement of lifetime registration under SORA, as they call it, S-O-R-A, Sex Offender Registration Act. The defendant appealed the Court of Appeals' decision to the Michigan Supreme Court. They remanded the case back with the directions to consider the cruel and unusual punishment argument.
So I'm not sure how he even got the issue before the court, because according to the opinion on page 2, for an issue to be preserved, and this is standard, for an issue to be preserved for appellate review, it must be raised and addressed and decided by the lower court. It noted the defendant did not argue that his sentence to lifetime PFR registration was unconstitutional, cruel, and unusual in the court below. Thus, the issue was not properly preserved for an appeal.
I saw that, and it stated that our review is for plain error affecting defendant's substantial rights. What in the effety F does that mean? What is plain error?
Well, since I'm not licensed to practice law, I'm going to choose to read from the opinion. I hope I can stumble my way through it. The court stated, to avoid forfeiture under the plain error rule, three requirements must be met. One, error must have occurred. Two, the error was plain, i.e. clear and obvious. And three, the plain error affected substantial rights. Reversal is warranted only if the plain error resulted in a conviction of an innocent defendant, or if the error seriously affected the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings independent of the defendant's innocence. That's a pretty tough standard, because it doesn't sound like the jury was very convinced of his innocence to me.
Let me see if I have this correct. He did not raise the issue. This sounds like the Doe case, Larry, that they, because they did the, what's the settlement thing that we talk about all the time?
Summary judgment.
Summary judgment. It sounds like because they didn't bring it up at the lower, then they couldn't bring it up when it went to the Supreme Court. That's what this sounds like to me. Since he didn't raise the issue below, he's barred from raising it on appeal, right?
You kind of had it correct, other than they can look at for plain error, and they didn't see any plain error.
Okay, so I do kind of have that care. All right, seems to me that he would have been at the mercy of his attorney, and how can they hold him responsible for what his attorney failed to do?
Well, remember, I'm guessing, so people don't send us ugly emails. I'm guessing that the attorney felt that the cruel and unusual punishment argument lacked merit, and it was doomed to fail. Thus, the attorney refused to put that forward. And if I had been on the legal team, I would have told the guy the same thing. You can make this silly argument, but it's not going to work. And we'll make it for you. I would make it. I mean, if I were licensed, I would make the argument. And the judge is going to rock his chair back or her chair back and look at you like you're nuts. But go ahead. That's what probably happened.
All right. Well, Michigan SORA requires the defendant to register for the rest of his life, including after his release from prison, because he was convicted of assault with intent to commit sexual penetration. This is a Tier 3 offense under the statute. Can you admit, Larry, because Michigan SORA imposes affirmative obligations amounting to an onerous burden on registrants?
Yes, I can admit that, but that does not make, just because there are burdens, that doesn't make it cruel and unusual punishment.
Under Michigan SORA, Tier 3 offenders must report any changes to their residence, employment, email addresses, and telephone numbers, and must report in person 4 times a year to verify their residence. Can you admit to me that that's a disability and restraint?
I can, but again, that doesn't make it cruel and unusual punishment. It's a disability and restraint.
A registrant's personal information, including a physical description and photograph, as well as their home address, license plate number, must also be made available to the public. What do you say to justify all of that?
I have nothing to say that justifies all that. In fact, I vehemently disagree with the practice. I would say that in this area of the law, that's where you might potentially have the most vulnerability to a legal challenge. But we need to fully develop a case with credible evidence that shows what occurs due to internet publication. This means, all you practitioners out there, don't file a motion for summary judgment. Come in with a war chest of about $100,000 and be prepared to put on expert testimony. No summary judgment. Build a framework that allows for this finding that the internet publication is imposing a significant disability and possibly even death or serious injury. Have proof. Anecdotal evidence is not good enough.
Let's move on to the cruel and unusual punishment standard. The court stated, to determine whether a punishment is cruel or unusual under the Michigan Constitution, courts assess whether it is unjustifiably disproportionate to the offense committed by considering 4 factors, the harshness of the penalty compared to the gravity of the offense, the penalty imposed for the offense compared to penalties imposed for other offenses in Michigan, the penalty imposed for the offense in Michigan compared to the penalty imposed for the same offense in other states, and whether the penalty imposed advances the goal of rehabilitation. Shall we go through their analysis on each of the 4?
I think that's a good idea.
Perfect. So number 1, on their first point, the defendant cited People versus DiPiazza. In that case, an 18-year-old defendant was convicted of attempted third-degree criminal sexual conduct after a teacher discovered that he was in a relationship with a nearly 15-year-old girl. Excuse me. The defendant was sentenced to register as a PFR for 10 years as a result of the conviction. The same court held that a 10-year registration requirement was too harsh. I can't wait for you to spin your way out of this one. If that guy got 10 years, how does this guy get lifetime?
That was a whole different case, but I'll let the court do the spinning. They said, in comparison, to the not very grave circumstances of the crime, now they're talking about DiPiazza, considering the relatively minimal age difference and the consensual nature of the relationship of which the parents approved, the court considered the relatively, the court also noted that the defendant of the alleged victim later married. So that's a completely different case with DiPiazza than this case.
So I see that on page 4. They also stated, given the starkly different nature of the present case, we find DiPiazza in opposite. In contrast to DiPiazza, which involved a statutory rape situation between two consenting teenagers, the instant case involved a violent, non-consensual, and humiliating sexual assault by a defendant against the victim. The defendant offered to help the complainant as a pretext for luring her to a room where he forcibly detained her, blah, 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 and until she escaped. The offense here was far more severe than the offense in DiPiazza. Consequently, we do not find lifetime registration unduly harsh in this instance. I see your point of the facts of the challenger can alter the outcome.
Indeed it can. And just as we've talked about the case in Georgia with Wendy Whitaker, she was the proper plaintiff to make the challenge that the school bus prohibitions, they had this law in Georgia for a period of time where if you lived within proximity of a school bus you would have to move. And those were subject to being changed every school term. And her offense was very benign as compared to most PFR type offenses. She was the ideal challenger. This is something that most people, when they want to, well, I want to file an appeal. And I said, well, wait a minute, you're not going to be very attractive to the court. Well, the courts are not supposed to look at that. Well, but they do. They're humans. And this was one of those cases where, had I had the opportunity, I'd have told them, they're not going to like you very much. They're not going to be wanting to give you any relief. You did not do anything that's going to endure any sympathy from the court. You have to understand that and accept that. Wendy Whitaker did something that everybody could relate to. She had an oral sexual encounter with a student approximately her age, but she was above the age, and the male student was not. But everybody could relate to that. I can't think of a soul out there that we could tell the story of what we just read that could relate to what he did. Can you?
No, I don't see how that one works out. So then the defendant next argued that sentencing him to lifetime PFR registration is a disproportionate penalty when compared to sentences for other crimes in Michigan. How did that argument go, Larry?
Not well. He argued that the CSC sentence is subject him to lifetime punishment that lasts even after prison. The court noted, contrary to his contention, many other offenses have statutorily mandated penalties in Michigan. They cited laws mandating minimum terms, including a 25-year minimum term of imprisonment for certain fourth offense habitual offenders, and they cited mandating terms of imprisonment for those who possessed a firearm during the commission of a felony, and they cited mandating life imprisonment for an adult defendant convicted of first-degree murder. He was just simply wrong with his assertions.
The defendant also argued that Michigan's mandatory registration system is unduly harsh when compared to other states. He cited the Massachusetts Supreme Court, which ruled that a defendant convicted of a PFR offense is required to register under a tiered system, but that the tier or level assignment to each defendant must be determined by an individualized evaluation. He also pointed out that Arkansas's registration requirements must be established on the basis of a recidivism assessment. Why didn't that one work?
Well, as the court stated, Michigan is far from unique in requiring PFRs to register for life. Requiring lifetime compliance with SORA is justified in this situation, and that's on page 5. A lot of states, I mean, pure wind-driven Florida, pure wind-driven Maryland, they have some lifetime registration offenses. And Florida has, I think everybody's on for lifetime, unless you can fit within that small zone of people who can petition for removal. But lifetime registration, lifetime inclusion in a civil regulatory scheme is not necessarily cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, sorry to break it to you.
The defendant's final argument was that his sentence to a lifetime on the SORA registry is contrary to the goal of rehabilitation because he will suffer stigma interfering with his ability to acquire housing and employment. That, you have to admit, that is totally true.
I can admit that. but unfortunately did not raise the issue below, nor did he provide proof of these assertions. The court's response based on lack of evidence was, while it is plausible, remember, because there was no evidence, the defendant's presence on the registry will complicate aspects of future life circumstances, those negative effects could be attributed to defendant having engaged in conduct resulting in convictions of offenses that happened to fall under SOAR's ambit, rather than the registry itself. And they stated, defendant's lifetime SOAR requirement is not unjustifiably disproportionate because PFR registration may deter defendant from recidivating in the future. So he placed himself through his attorney or whatever, he got himself in a position where he didn't build any evidence. Didn't have any evidence to show that it's the registry causing these negative consequences. You can't just throw up an assertion in court and say, oh, well, the registry is doing all this. Remember, the burden of proof is on you.
So what happens next?
Well, as I read the opinion, it goes back to the trial court for resentencing, and if I read it correctly, but my guess is that he will probably try to get back before the Michigan Supreme Court on the cruel and unusual punishment argument, because he's not going to want to accept the mid-level appeal court as being the final authority on that. So my expectation is that this case will go back to the Supreme Court, at least on some sort of petition. Whether they'll hear it or not, I don't know, but the argument is doomed. It's not cruel and unusual punishment.
How does that compare to the Kennedy Mendoza? Does that fall into something being unconstitutional because the Supreme Court made that decision? And if something imposes these disabilities and restraints, does that make it cruel and unusual or just unconstitutional?
It just makes that the retroactive application under that test. If you retroactively impose what you're describing as a civil regulatory scheme on people retroactively, then that's where that test comes into place. Is it truly a civil regulatory scheme that doesn't impose any disability or restraint? If it truly is a civil regulatory scheme, you can do that retroactively. For example, young men between 18 and 26 have to register for the draft, right?
Yep.
Okay. You could be on your 25th birthday. Let's take it up to the most ridiculous, just shy of 26. You could have had your 25th birthday, and they could decide that the need for warm bodies because of military conflict that's ongoing or on the horizon, that they want to raise that age to 28 or 30. Requiring you to register for the draft is not punitive. They could make that change retroactively, and you could do all the Kennedy, Mendoza, Martinez analysis you would want to, and it wouldn't yield any results because no one's being punished by registering for the draft. So that's what that test is about. If they have a true civil regulatory scheme, they can impose it on you retroactively. They can change the food handling temperatures and the parts per million in the restaurant. They can do all those things retroactively because they're not intended to punish anybody.
And this goes back to the thing that I say a lot. It's not the registration part that anybody should ever complain about, which, sure, if you go register 4 times a year, that's a pain in the ass. But having your picture on the website, your address listed, your license plate number, phone number, all that garbage, along with the public side of that is really, and then like in wherever we were just talking about having the increase of the 2,500 feet, that quote unquote civil regulatory scheme, when they do those things, that's when this becomes such a pain in the ass.
And that's when you cross the line and you can't impose those things retroactively. But you can impose a regulatory scheme, a true regulatory scheme retroactively, and it's not unconstitutional. So, but we've got a couple of articles to try to cover. Can we do it?
Yeah, we do. We have, we can at least cover the first one. And let's see here. I will pull up the article. This is from The Hill. The title is Presley, Markey Reintroduced Bill to End Qualified Immunity. I see that Representative Ayanna Pressley and Senator Ed Markey have reintroduced legislation to end qualified immunity. Qualified immunity is a legal doctrine that protects government officials from individual liability for violating personal and constitutional rights. Do you think it will pass there, Larry?
I don't think there's a chance in hell that this will pass. This will be cast as a proposal sponsored by the radical left, Both sponsors are liberal Democrats from Massachusetts, and we've talked about this before. Ending qualified immunity would restore Americans' ability to obtain relief when state and local officials, including police officers, violate citizens' legal and constitutional rights. There'll be too much opposition from law enforcement, and the Republicans will join that opposition, and it will not pass as a result of that opposition.
This proposal was originally introduced in June of 2020, Presley and former Representative Justin Amash, following the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer. Speaking to reporters outside the Capitol on Wednesday, Presley and Markey both condemned the doctrine and announced that they will build a new coalition of sponsors backed by advocates and families who have been stopped from seeking justice by the doctrine to end qualified immunity. Does this not persuade other members of Congress?
Well, marginally, but no, I don't think it will persuade enough people to pass it. But they went on to say, for too long, qualified immunity has impeded legal recourse and blocked meaningful accountability. Presley even stated it makes no sense that the very people responsible for enforcing the law face no consequences for breaking the law.
The qualified immunity doctrine was invented by the Supreme Court in 1967. It disallows police officers from being out on trial for unlawful conduct, including the use of excessive or deadly force, unless the person suing proves that both the conduct was unlawful and the officers knew they were violating clearly established. I'm really confused because since this was invented by the Supreme Court, why can't they undo it the same way that they did with Roe versus Wade?
Well, they actually could undo it the same way that they did, but they're not likely to do so. This is a very conservative-leaning Law and Order Supreme Court, so that's wishful thinking. But you're right, they could undo it.
Quote, this is a law by the courts, just out of thin air, and it has impacted families, Representative Presley said. They have been blocked from justice, they have been blocked and denied accountability, and so now we need to block qualified immunity and this unjust doctrine that has been codified and strengthened court case after court case. Do you think there's any hope?
I would say, well, very little hope. I'd say there's no hope in the federal system as the current makeup of Congress makes that impossible. But some states have moved to reduce or eliminate qualified immunity as a defense. And this has become increasingly controversial as advocates for police reform argue that it absolves law enforcement officials of responsibility in the deaths of unarmed citizens, particularly Black Americans.
Supporters of the doctrine say officers should not have to fear lawsuits for doing their jobs. Senator Tim Scott, Republican of South Carolina, has since tried to offer a compromise that would allow police departments to be held financially liable in civil suits, but not individual officers. Since Floyd's murder, at least 25 states are considering some form of qualified immunity reform, and that's according to CNN.
Yes, and folks, if you really are for being able to hold law enforcement accountable, and we've had guests who express alarm that we can't, this is one of the barriers that stands in the way. So just keep that in mind as you go into the election.
And I guess if we can do this one quickly, we can do this last one here. We should do this one. This is from Reason Magazine. DeSantis signs Florida law setting lowest threshold for death penalty sentences in the country. Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed legislation into law today, lowering the threshold for a jury to recommend a death penalty sentence for unanimity to an 8-4 majority, the lowest standard in the country. Alabama is the only other state that allows split juries to recommend death sentences, and it requires a 10-2 majority. So you got to tell me there, Dr. Doom and Gloom, what's wrong with this?
Well, nothing if you support the use of this barbaric practice of putting people to death.
What's the reason for Florida moving in this direction?
Well, I don't live there, but my speculation is, and it alluded to it in the article, you remember John Hinckley, the one who was found not guilty by reason of insanity for attempting to assassinate Ronald Reagan?
I never met him, but I remember the incident. I was very young.
Well, in the federal system, they all but abolished the insanity defense, and many states followed suit. And according to the article, DeSantis began pushing for this legislation after three jurors refused to vote the death penalty for Nicholas Cruz, who was the one convicted of killing 7 people at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in 2018. Cruz was instead sentenced to life in prison, and that's not enough for DeSantis and most Floridians because they want that vengeance.
So the changes is the latest development in years of legal wrangling over Florida's death penalty. And then over in 2016, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Florida's death penalty law on Sixth Amendment grounds because it relied too heavily on determinations by judges rather than juries. At that point, the state allowed juries to impose the death penalty with as little as a 7-5 majority. God, that's almost split 50-50, Larry. In response to the Supreme Court ruling, state legislators rewrote the law to require 10 out of 12 jurors to recommend the death penalty. The Florida Supreme Court then invalidated the new legislation, writing that unanimous juries were required for death penalty sentences to comport with the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. That did not last very long, Larry. So they went, they voted to put a significant majority in there, and now they're making it 8-4. Got it. So what happens next?
Well, what happened next after that was that the outraged Floridians, they elected a more conservative Supreme Court. And that Supreme Court in 2020 reversed the 2016 ruling and declared that split juries could indeed impose death sentences. Opponents of returning the split jury recommendations for death sentences point to a number of capital sentences that have been overturned in Florida. 30 people have been exonerated from Florida's death row. Remember, they would be dead now, and or could be dead now, more than any other state. But folks, remember, elections have consequences. They really do.
Florida is just the worst. Florida is just the worst. I'm sorry for all of you that live there, and I'm happy that I did not ever get trapped up in Florida. God. So one of our longtime and best patrons, he's named Super Patron Mike. He is joining us tonight in chat, and he lives there. He's been on the registry for almost as long as you've been alive, Larry. And like every move he makes, he's financially well-established, and they just keep putting the screws to not him personally, but just his situation to make life shitty for no reason. Well, I mean, there's a reason, but not any specific reason.
Well, I would try to escape that place if it were me, but
it becomes very challenging when that's where your family is, your kids have ties to, like, it becomes complicated and messy.
Your life is pretty complicated and messy when you have those kind of restrictions on you also.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. Oh, you know, before we head out of here, Larry, I wanted to tell you something that, do you know who Rocky is in chat sometimes?
I've seen the name.
Okay. Well, he is in prison, and he texted me tonight, and he said, well, I heard that there was a fight in, I think, laundry, and they choked a guy out and they killed him. So it's better to get out of prison as soon as possible.
I agree with that. I've said that prisons are inherently dangerous and one day can make a difference. You remember we did this show about New Mexico. If you were in prison on February 28th and you got released, and if you were, that was a leap year in 1980 when that riot happened. If you were in prison on February 29th, 33 inmates died and many others were seriously injured. So it makes all the difference. One day can make
You've been listening to F.
Absolutely. So to close out the show, I do want to say, super duper thank you very much to all of our patrons that continue to make, to support the show and make it, to thank you very much for supporting it. Even as little a dollar a month, it helps out for those of you that aren't supporting, that I granted you access and to listen to the show, record us live for a dollar a month that you can come listen to us record it and be silly in chat and make fun of me and try to make me laugh and so forth. But I really do appreciate it. And thank you very much for everyone for listening, and Larry, all the work that you do, I do appreciate it. And well, without you. Further ado, man, we can close this thing out and say goodnight.
See you in a week, maybe.
Yeah, probably in a week. I'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Good night.